You're on a boat. The captain has just informed you that the ship is going down. You have a suspicion that there's a limited number of life rafts, though you don't know it. In that situation, you A, scramble to the deck as fast as you can to try to get on one of those lifeboats. B, head down to the grand ballroom to grab a last meal and enjoy a last dance as the band plays the final taps. Or C, make your way around to the various staterooms, trying to see if anybody's left anything significant behind that they don't really want anymore, before you make your way up to the deck to try to get on one of those lifeboats. What would you do? Now, I know that probably none of you are planning to be on a boat within the next couple days. Maybe some of you are headed for a cruise, but whether you are or whether you're not, the boat that you're on currently is sinking. It's a fact. As we study the book of Revelation, the book of Revelation makes it very clear that God, speaking through His Word, is saying that the world as we know it will come to an end one day. And knowing that the world will come to an end gives us lots and lots of insight as to that which is important today and that which is not important today. And as we study the book together, not only is it interesting to know where the world is going, but it's also essential that we adopt the priorities of knowing the outcome and live them in our lives today in such a way that we don't act the fool. You see, the fool is the one who, knowing the end, does not live in light of the end and orders their life in a manner that does not make sense in light of eternity. So this morning, as we open our Bibles to Revelation chapter 18, we're going to see a picture of a significant part of the world in which we live in today coming to an end, and that has great ramifications for the way that we view this world today and our life in it. Now, when we got to Revelation chapter 16, we saw the last of the angels pouring out the bowls of God's judgment on the earth. And when the seventh angel took that bowl that was filled with the full strength, undiluted wrath of God, and he poured it on the world, he said with a loud voice, "It is done. It is finished. The judgment of God is done, and the world as we know it will no longer exist." And then in chapter 17, 18, and 19, John records what he gets through the angel of one of the aspects of the world that we know that will disappear. And the first one we saw last week in chapter 17, the world of religion as we know it will disappear. In chapter 18, we see the world economy, the business life of the world, the financial and economic world coming to an end. There's only one more power in the world to take care of after that. That will come in chapter 19. That is the political portion. The political portion will come to an end when Jesus Christ rides in at the Battle of Armageddon and overthrows the Antichrist and the kings and sets up his government. Now, as we looked at chapter 17, we saw this term, Babylon, the great harlot. And we understood that that traces its origin all the way back to Genesis chapter 11 at the Tower of Babel when mankind came together in solidarity of politics, religion, and economy against God. That same concept, the term Babylon, refers to what will happen in the end when all of the world forms a one-world religion, a one-world economy, and a one-world government. That takes place during the tribulation period. And that is what we see in Revelation chapter 18, that the economic portion of that will come to an end. Let's look at it together. Revelation chapter 18, verse 1 says, "After this I saw another angel coming down from heaven. He had great authority, and the earth was illuminated by his splendor." Now this angel that's coming down to pronounce judgment on the economic system of the world, this angel is foreshadowing the coming of Jesus Christ in 19. You see, he's bright and he begins to illumine the world. He begins to bring light into the world, and we're going to see light coming into the dark world, and he's beginning to shed that light, which will ultimately come in chapter 19. And listen to the message that he has to proclaim. With a mighty voice he shouted, "Fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great. She has become a home for demons and a haunt for every evil spirit and a haunt for every unclean and detestable bird. For all the nations have drunk the maddening wine of her adulteries. The kings of the earth committed adultery with her, and the merchants of the earth grew rich from her excessive luxuries." Now what is going on here? What we see here is the second face of what was destroyed in chapter 17. This is the economic portion of the one world government. Now you say, well, why would God judge economics? I mean, that's an amoral system, right? I mean, money is not immoral. It's not moral. It's neutral. A business is neutral, isn't it? Why would God bring down judgment on our economic system in the world? Well, as we look at the passage closely, we begin to understand. He says in verse 2, "Fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great. She has become a home for what? A home for demons, and a haunt for every evil spirit, and a haunt for every unclean and detestable bird." Now, what is being described here? What he's saying is that the economic system of the world government in the end will be a place that is monopolized, controlled by demonic forces. Demonic powers, unclean spirits, and even detestable birds. Symbolic of the carrion birds, the birds that eat flesh, the buzzards. That will be the characteristic driving force behind the economic system in the last days. He goes on to say the result of that will be that all the nations have drunk the maddening wine of her adulteries. Now, adultery is very, very simple. We understand what that is when we're in a covenant relationship with someone else. And then we go off and commit adultery. We're getting involved in a relationship or an affair that is not part of the covenant that we're committed to. And as mankind, our relationship is with God, to worship Him only. Anytime that we would worship something other than God, where our heart and soul would be given over to something other than God, that's called adultery. And here we see the economic system of the end times, the world of money, the world of business, drawing away the hearts of people in a form of worship. And the text says this is a maddening intoxication. It's an irrational preoccupation, pull, draw towards stuff, towards success, toward money, toward the accumulation of things, toward pleasure. It's a gotta have it kind of mentality. And it's so overpowering that all the nations of the earth, all the people in the nations are all caught up in this feeding frenzy of material gain and material pleasure and the power that all of that brings. He goes on to say, the kings of the earth also committed adultery with her, and the merchants of the earth grew rich from her excessive luxuries. Excessive luxuries means incredible self-indulgence. Incredible self-indulgence. Now, let's face it, folks. We don't know for sure when the end will come. It could happen any time now. It may happen in our lifetime. But when it comes to a society that would fit a description of this end times economic system, it kind of feels close to home to me. Does it feel that way to you? I mean, throughout history, has there ever been a people that did excess better than us? From the rich to the poor in our society, the accumulation and the stockpiling of material possessions, pleasure and power that's associated with money certainly characterizes our society. Remember the days when you used to go down and buy a car, and as you look down the list of all the optional equipment, you'd say, yeah, I really need that, but I don't need this. I could live without that. Well, you know, I really do need that, but I really, you know, that I don't need. And you made a decision based on what you felt like you needed. And today you go down and buy a car, and all of the things that you did not opt for 10 or 15 or 20 years ago because you thought it was luxury, too expensive, that's all standard equipment today. Now, does it cost less because it's standard equipment? Have you priced an automobile lately? It's outrageous, isn't it? You know what has happened? The standard for standard has moved. It used to be that an automobile was simply a means of transportation. Now it's a driving experience. Four wheels and an engine do not make a driving experience. You've got to have much more than that. And what has happened is, in our culture, in our society today, we have all moved to where what needs and wants have changed. Let me give you another example. Remember the days when talking dad into going to Dairy Queen or McDonald's for a hamburger, that was a big family deal? Can you remember back that far? I remember in our family, every 2 weeks we'd go into town to buy groceries, and we would beg to stop and get some French fries at that place with those two big yellow arches out in front. You know what my mother would say? Kids, we don't need that. We don't need that. Now, we say to our kids, hey, y'all, we're thinking about going out to eat tonight, and we're thinking about going over here to get some pizza. And one of the kids says, oh, no, I don't want to go to pizza. I want to go to McDonald's. And another kid says, McDonald's? I don't want to go to McDonald's. I want to go to Burger King. And another kid says, I don't want to go to Burger King. I want to go to Rosie's. What happened? I live in a culture, and you live in a culture too, where eating out is not something unusual, out of the ordinary. It's not an extravaganza. It's something that's normal. We all do it. And spending money in that way is normal. Now, what happened? We have moved where what we thought before was something that was just a real luxury, something unusual, something special, is now commonplace, normal, average. It's average. Where most 16-year-olds believe that they have the divine right to receive not just an automobile, but a truck. And a late model black one at that. What happened? You see, we live in a world where excess becomes normal. And we live in a culture where worshiping stuff is just part of life. It's part of the American way. It's part of doing business. Now, the society of the end times will be characterized worldwide by this kind of thinking. And the people who will hold the power in the world will be the merchants, the businessmen, the men who control the bucks, and the women who control the bucks. And that empire will be destroyed. That will come down in the end. Notice the response of God to this. He says in verse 4, then I heard another voice from heaven say, come out of her, my people, so that you will not share in her sins, so that you will not receive any of her plagues. From the time when God called Lot out of Sodom and Gomorrah, all through Scripture, God has been calling his people to come out of that type of world and live a different kind of lifestyle. John, in the Epistle of John, chapter 2, in verse 15, says, do not love the world, neither the things that are in the world. He says, for all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eye, the boastful pride of life, these things are not of God, they're from the world. And then he goes on to say, and the world is passing away. Those things in the world is passing away, and the lusts thereof, that is the desires associated with the stuff of the world, that's going to be gone. But the one who does the will of God will live or endure forever. God's people have always been called out, and these people who are living in the tribulation, Christian people in the last days, those who are saved during that 7-year period, are called to come out of that system, to live lives that are differently than that. Now, that doesn't mean to go get a tent and move out of the world and not live in society. What that means is do not give your heart to the stuff of the world, to pleasure, to power, to status, to things. Don't give your heart to that in the same way that the pagan person is, that the person who doesn't know God, who doesn't know any better, is giving their heart to it. Don't give your heart to it. Come out of that. And he tells us the reason why we must come out of that is so that we don't share in the same sin, so that we don't commit these same kind of sins that the rest of the people around us commit. Now, if you measured yourself against those people who live in your world around you, how would you stack up? Is there a measurable difference in your heart and the way you approach the stuff of life. When the advertising which tries to convince you that life consists in things and the accumulation of things, when that comes across your mind, when you see that, does it sicken you? Does it highlight for you how much different your values are? Or do you find yourself humming the tunes and your heart following those things? Come out, he says, and be different. He says, verse 5, for her sins are piled up to heaven. Just as the bricks of the Tower of Babel were piled up, so her sins are piled up, and God has remembered her. Give back to her as she has given. Pay her back double for what she has done. Mix her a double portion from her own cup. Give her as much torture and grief as the glory and luxury she gave herself. And what he's saying here is that she has done some things, given glory to herself, given luxury to herself, become haughty, and God is going to give her punishment equal to what she has done. Now, we know about this debate because as a culture, we've been wrestling with it. In fact, most people, I think, had their minds made up from the beginning, but the whole system of justice has revolved around a current situation that has occurred where we have a man who took the lives of 168 innocent people in order to make a point. And the debate has been, and now it's settled, whether Timothy McVeigh should get the death penalty or not. In other words, from the standpoint of what he's done, does he deserve to have it done to him, that is, his life be taken? And we've seen that the court has ruled yes and given him the death sentence. And the passage is saying that in the same way that she has sinned against God, God is also going to judge her and give her back what she has given. He says, double a portion, mix her cup with double a portion and give it back. And he tells why. He says, because in her heart, give her as much torture and grief, verse 7, as the glory and luxury she gave herself. Now this word glory means self-glorification. The economic system of the world takes pride in itself. It glories in itself, opposed to God. Now notice one little comment in verse 23. In verse 23, the middle of the verse, it says, your merchants were the world's great men. Now, it doesn't say your statesmen were the world's great men, politicians. It doesn't say your soldiers or your war heroes were the world's great men. It doesn't say your educators were the world's great men. It says that in this system, this economic system of the end times, the great men, the really important guys, are the ones who are the merchants. Now, you can substitute for merchant, businessman. Because the merchants were the businessmen of the ancient world. They're the ones who controlled the money. They controlled the flow of goods coming in and going out. They held the retail market. They held the wholesale market. They held the financial market. They were the businessmen of the world. And it says, under an economic system where the economy or having power based on money is the god, the great gurus, the priests, the high priests of the world become the businessmen of the world. And her glory is to place importance on the businessmen of the world. Seems very similar to what we see today. The names that are household names today, besides athletes, would be businessmen. And when Lee Iacocca writes a book, everybody's going to go down and read it. Do they read it because of his character? Do they read it because of his family life? Do they read it because of his commitment to marriage? Do they read it because of what he's done for the society? And I'm not suggesting he's done anything wrong. But the reason why people read it is because of who he is. A powerful man. Controls corporations and money. Donald Trump owns vast holdings. And when he writes a book or makes a statement, it's on the media. People read it because he's powerful, because he has money. And the most powerful of all, you know, is Bill Gates. And when Bill Gates says something, the majority of the people in this room hear about it in a relatively short period of time. Why? Why? Because the great men of the world are the ones that have the money and the power and control commerce and trade and business. They become the gods of the world. And they're worshipped as the superheroes. Not only that, she puts forth glory, but she also puts forth luxury, and she spends it on herself. The word luxury is self-indulgence. That's the world in which we will see. And it goes on to say, in her heart she boasts, I sit as queen. I'm the most important. I'm the queen bee. I'm not a widow, and I will never mourn. Therefore, in one day her plagues will overtake her, death, mourning, and famine. She will be consumed by fire, for mighty is the Lord God who judges her. There's a day coming. There's a day coming when the economic system will end. It will be judged. And when that day comes, there's great fallout from it. We see three groups of people that mourn over her. Verse 9, when the kings of the earth who committed adultery with her and shared her luxury see the smoke of her burning, they will weep and mourn over her. Terrified at her torment, they will stand far off and cry, woe, woe, O great city, O Babylon, city of power, in one hour your doom has come. They weep and mourn and they cry because they've received their power from a world economic system. They don't get hurt the worst, though. The next group gets hurt the worst. Look at verse 11. The merchants of the earth will weep and mourn over her because no one buys their cargo anymore. The businessmen of the world will mourn because there's no more market for their products. No more consumers. Nobody's interested. And look what they have to sell. It's pretty good. Cargoes of gold, silver, precious stones, and pearls. Fine linen, purple, silk, and scarlet cloth. Every sort of citron wood and articles of every kind made of ivory, costly wood, bronze, iron, and marble. Cargoes of cinnamon and spice, of incense, myrrh, frankincense, of wine and olive oil, of fine flour and wheat, cattle and sheep, horses and carriages, and bodies and souls of men. Even to the point where they're trafficking in humanity, selling people. They will say, the fruit you long for is gone from you. All your riches and splendor have vanished, never to be recovered. The merchants who sold these things and gained their wealth from her will stand far off, terrified at her torment. They will weep and mourn and cry out, woe, woe, great city, dressed in fine linen, purple and scarlet, and glittering with gold, precious stones and pearls. In one hour, such great wealth has been brought to ruin. Can you imagine what it's going to be like for the great, wealthy, powerful businessmen on the day when this comes? On the day in the future when the Dow Jones Industrial bottoms out at zero and nobody's buying or selling because there's no value in those pieces of paper and the companies anymore. You know what? There's coming a day when Big Blue will never produce another computer again. Not because Dell overcame and with market share pushed Big Blue off the face of the earth. Because there's coming a day when Dell will never produce another computer again. There's coming a day when we'll never have to worry about smoke belching out of a GM factory that's producing automobiles because there will be no more General Motors. And we'll never have to worry about another Exxon oil spill because there will be no more Exxon. There's coming a day when everything that we know it in the economic world in which we live will no longer exist. It will collapse. It will be no more. Now here's wisdom. Would you give your heart to something that's terminal? Would you give your heart to something that's terminal? I'm not saying move out of the world and disappear into oblivion. We live in the world. We're placed in the world. There's nothing wrong with having a career, with working, with earning a living, but where is your heart? Are you giving your heart to something that will go away? How many tears are shed over stuff that's not going to last? How many marriages break up over career changes, over worry and stress? From where the next dollar is coming from, over disagreements on spending, over retirement accounts. How many families are torn apart when grandma dies and everybody goes at each other's throat trying to get that last nickel? How often does that happen? It's a matter of the heart. And if you give your heart to a system that ultimately will go away, will ultimately fail, it's a very, very, very crazy, silly thing to do. And yet most of us who live in the world are told every day, this is what's important. Get it now. Get there now, because this is what will make you happy. And ultimately, that's all going to die. It's all going to disappear. It's all going to go away. He goes on to speak of one more group. Every sea captain and all who travel by ship, the sailors, And all who earn their living from the sea will stand far off when they see the smoke of her burning. They will exclaim, "Was there ever a city like this great city?" They will throw dust on their heads and with weeping and mourning cry out, "Woe, woe, O great city, where all who had ships on the sea became rich through her wealth. In 1 hour she has been brought to ruin." I think he's talking about the employees of the world. All the way from the guy who runs the ship for the merchant, the businessman, to the guy who loads the ship for the business and the merchants and the businessmen, all of those guys are going to stand back and mourn too, because their source of income is gone too. You don't have to be on the top of the economic scale to be in love with the world and to give your heart to the stuff of this life. And even that group of people will stand back and say, "We poured our heart and soul into it. We got rich off this, and now it's gone. And now it's gone." Heaven has a different attitude, though, in verse 20. Heaven says, "Rejoice over her, O heaven. Rejoice, saints and apostles and prophets. God has judged her for the way she treated you." Heaven takes a completely different view. Verse 21, "Then a mighty angel picked up a boulder the size of a large millstone and threw it into the sea and said, 'With such violence, the great city of Babylon will be thrown down, never to be found again.'" The millstone in question here is a large millstone, probably 4 feet across, 5 feet across, and a foot thick. And he takes this millstone, this boulder the size of a millstone, and he throws it in the water, and he says, "This is what it's going to be like." And then he describes the reality in human terms. Notice what he says. Verse 22, "The music of the harpist and musicians, flute players and trumpeters will never be heard again in you. The lights of Broadway will go out. The sign on Hollywood Hills will come down. Never will the Boston Pops play again at a concert in the round." That's all gone. That system and all of the finer things associated with that, the music of it is gone. Not only that, "No workman of any trade will ever be found in you again. There'll never be a day to find that little shop that sells that Waterford crystal, to buy a lamp or a piece of crystal and take it home, because there'll be no craftsman making that stuff anymore. It's all gone away. There's no craftsman left. The sound of the millstone will never be heard in you again. There won't be any need to find a Ruth's Chris to get that perfect steak. There won't be any restaurants. There won't even be any grinding of the millstone. The light of the lamp will never shine in you again." The lamp that's being described here is a little lamp, a small table lamp, one that would burn on the kitchen table of someone in the ancient world. I picture here a family sitting around the table counting out their shekels, looking over the stuff that they have. That's all gone. There'll never be a lighted lamp of anyone in this economic system that's coming crashing down. And finally, "The voice of the bridegroom and the bride will never be heard in you again." There's not going to be any wedding receptions, no celebrations, because a bride and a groom, they get married and they go off to start something new, to raise a family, to perpetuate this. And he's saying this system is dead and gone, and there'll never be a time when humanity will ever populate the system again. They'll never live in the system. They'll never work in the system. They'll never marry in the system. The system is gone. The end of the world of economics as we know it today is going away. And he concludes with, "In her was found the blood of the prophets." Excuse me. "Your merchants were the world's great men." Verse 23. "By your magic spell, all the nations were led astray. In her was found the blood of the prophets and of the saints and all who have been killed on the earth." Within that economic system, the world nodded as Christianity was persecuted, as the voice of the prophets were put down. Now, he gives a great picture here. The picture of the giant boulder. Now, this is what it's going to be like. The boulder's tossed into the water. And you know what happens when you throw a big rock in the water? Probably did that when you were kids, you know, picked up a big rock over your head and you throw it in the water and it's just kerplunk, you know, it kind of sucks the water down in and it splashes back up. Well, that's what it's going to be like. There's going to be this big splash and then it splashes back up. And what happens after that? The water gets calm, right? We were talking at the Father-Son Campout, and we were reminiscing about last year's Father-Son Campout, where a bunch of us took our sons and we went out to Inks Lake. And there's a place on Inks Lake where there's this big bunch of rocks and this high bluff and boulder. It looks like it's probably 30, 35, maybe 40 feet up there. And there were a few people crazy enough to get up and jump off of this thing. And, you know, of course, I thought, well, I'll climb up there and see what it looks like. And I got up there and I looked down and I saw two things. One, it was a long way down. And the other one was my 7-year-old son was sitting there looking up at me going. And, you know, I thought for a moment, I thought, well, I could climb back down here and I could say, you know, son, I've thought this over, and, you know, looking at the height and all of the things that could go wrong, I'm not so sure my insurance would cover bodily injuries from this. And, you know, really, as the provider of this family, I think it's in best wisdom that I come down off of that. That wouldn't have gone very well at that moment, so I jumped off of this thing. And when you jump off of it, it's a long way down, and you hit the water, and there's a big splash. Well, there was a guy that got up there that was really, really big. I mean, he was bigger than me. This guy was huge. And he climbed up to the top of that thing, and he jumped off. And when he hit the water, all of Ink's Lake sucked into that hole behind him. I mean, there was just this huge inversion of water. And then all of a sudden, it came splashing back up all over the place. And then you know what happened? The water got calm again. Just flat, calm, as if it never had happened. You know what the angel is picturing here for us? There's going to come a day when the economic system of the world goes down like a splash. And when it hits the water, it's going to make the biggest sucking sound in the world, because all of the hopes and dreams of humanity are going to get sucked into that. And there's going to be this big splash. And then after that, you know what's going to happen? Nothing. It's going to get calm. And that world that we live in today that will climax in the end times, that world is going to go away, and everybody's going to forget about it, because Jesus Christ is going to set up his kingdom, a kingdom built on righteousness, a kingdom built on relationships, a kingdom that is so much more satisfying, that is so superior to the silliness in which we live today, to the craziness in which we give our hearts to the stuff of this world today, that nobody will even remember it anymore. And everyone will bask in the glow of the beauty and the glory of the world that Jesus Christ will establish on the face of this earth. And we think that there's a way to get it good here by getting more, and it's crazy. I don't know how you feel about this world, but when a president or a presidential candidate stands up and with a simple statement, "Are you better off today than you were 4 years ago?" and sways the nation, are you kidding me? You mean all of the issues in all of the world boil down to whether I can pull my wallet out of my pocket and see if there's more money in it today than there was 4 years ago? That is insulting. Don't you feel incensed by that? Can you be bought and sold by your political people, by your company, by the advertisers? Is life as simple as dollars and cents? It's not. And there's coming a day when all that we know and the dreams of this economic world in which we live in will all go away. And you know what's coming? We'll be so far superior to that. We're going to look back and we're going to say, boy, that was silly. It was silly to spend the night crying over a missed opportunity, or being sad over a fender bender that messed up the corner of my perfect automobile, when all of life does not consist in the stuff, the pursuit, the pleasure. It doesn't consist in that. So here's the question. The boat's going down. What are you going to do? What are you going to do? Are you going to go join the ball? Just join the party? I mean, hey, if it's going down, everybody's going down with it. I'm going to live here and enjoy life and just forget about the future. You know, that's silly. That's like saying, hey, the apartment's on fire, but not to worry. There are going to be a whole bunch of other people burned up here with me. Or, you know, the tornado's coming and I need to find shelter, but, you know, there are a whole bunch of other people standing out here and watch it too. They're going to get blown away too. That's crazy. Take cover. Get out of the building. Get on the lifeboat. Is that what you're going to do? You know, what's even more crazy than that, I think, but it's the view that many of us take is we're going to run around to all the staterooms and grab as much of this stuff as we can. We know that we may miss the boat in the process, but you know, we're going to try to get a hold of it, even though it doesn't mean anything anymore. We're going to try to carry it with us. When we have the opportunity to get on the lifeboat of Jesus Christ and to sail off into the glory and the beauty of the kingdom of Jesus Christ, that which will give so much more, so much more. Is there anything wrong with having a dollar? Is there anything wrong with having $1 million? No. Is there anything wrong with having a career? Is there anything wrong with having a successful career? No. That's not the issue. The issue is heart. Where is your heart? In the last days, God will bring the economic system of mankind, which makes people drunk on excessive materialism. He'll bring that to an end. And then the good days start. Let's start living today in light of those good days. Let's bow our heads for prayer. Father in heaven, we just come before you thanking you that you're the kind of God who has so much more to offer. Most of us have lived just long enough to taste just enough to know that we can really get addicted to fun and to pleasure, to fame and success, to the finer things in life. Father, guard our hearts. Help us to keep our hearts focused on you. May we be people who truly understand the end and live our lives in light of the end. Father, you promised us so many things in Jesus Christ. May we treasure Jesus Christ. May there be nothing in our lives and hearts that take priority over him. He's so much more than anything here. Lord, we thank you for Jesus. Draw our hearts to him this morning, for we pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen.